Hello, everyone, and welcome into yet another debate night. Thank you all so much for tuning in live, or if you're listening post on Apple Music, Spotify, wherever you find your podcast. Really appreciate each and every one of you tuning in. I'm Hunter, joined as always by Brody. We got Silas in the producing booth, and the first major of the year is officially over. Well, the talking points are just getting started, though. Things have been going kind of crazy since then, but as we get the show started, Brody, let's just hear your side of the first major of the year. What was it like for you? I know you texted us that you're struggling a little bit on the front nine, it seemed. It seemed like the back nine you played pretty well. Front nine, you struggled a little bit. Walk us through it.
Yeah, well, I basically sucked. to put it lightly. No, but this was one of those courses that I feel like in the past I would have really struggled at.
Yeah.
And I've gotten my putt pretty good. I missed three putts inside of 25 feet in a row, all for birdie in round, I think it was either two or three. Whichever round I shot six under, I had three putts that would have been great to kind of actually have a decent round.
Yeah.
Outside of those three putts and outside of missing a 15 footer on hole one the final day, my circle one putting felt great. I made a lot of circle two putts.
Nice.
I think I was third or fourth in strokes gained from circle two. So my putting kept me in it. And if I wasn't nearly as good scrambling from just throwing all sorts of different angles, forehands, and I think I carried probably six discs in that I would throw inside of like 150 feet.
Oh, geez.
Just based off of different angles, different flights and all that stuff. So if it wasn't for that, I think I would have probably been way at the bottom of the leaderboard, where I ended up basically smack dab in the middle. Frustrating, obviously. I wanted to do a lot better than that. But again, it's one of those, I'm trying to take the positives out of it and try to figure out how to continue to get better and better. And, you know, that part of my game, hitting gaps is still a part of my game that I need to get better at. That's a course, as you saw, if you're not hitting your lines off the tee, you can't really score well out there.
Yeah.
If you are hitting your lines off the tee, you can shred. So that was kind of my reaction to my overall play. I got to watch Corey Ellis shoot his incredible round that he did in round one. So that was nuts. I think it was 10 or 11 under. And yeah, I mean, it was overall an awesome tournament, an incredible course. I hope they figure something out so we can get back there, because I do think it should be a mainstay on the tournament. And here's an interesting thing, because I was thinking about this, of where the UFC, they basically, because I was always thinking, like, I've just been under the impression of, if a course can't handle spectators, they sold 400 spectator passes at W.R. Jackson.
Well, 400 a day. 400 people were on there a day.
Per day.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's no.
Yeah. Really small.
And I was always under the impression of, like, we need to be at events and courses that can handle thousands and thousands of spectators. But I might be going back on that. I might have opened my eyes, because I was thinking about how the UFC did stuff at COVID. When COVID hit, UFC couldn't have a crazy amount of fans at the events. And so instead of them going to these big venues, they wanted to do it at the Apex, which is at their UFC headquarters in Las Vegas. And it was a very intimate kind of scene. When it first happened, people loved it because it was like a different feel to it. And I'm thinking, obviously our production is not there. That's the thing that's lacking right now. But if you could get enough cameras out at W.R. Jackson and you know, increase the production of the actual live coverage, I think you could potentially have an event, maybe not a major, but you could have an event that was more geared towards watching live instead of like being there in person, like a product that you put out to people to tune into versus a product that, because again, there's no way you're going to have 5,000 spectators at W.R. Jackson.
No,
it cannot, it can't happen.
Yeah.
So I don't like the idea though of just saying, well, this course can't handle it, they're out. The course is so good. So it's like, can we come up with other creative ways to maybe turn this into the biggest watched tournament of where everyone's tuning in to watch it because the production of it is so good. And then, you know, I do think it gives you a different vibe when there are minimum spectators watching well. And if that's something that's known, then I don't think it comes off as lame, where I think sometimes when you're watching a disc golf highlight or even on, you know, when I'm watching Ultimate Frisbee stuff and, you know, they pan to the crowd and there's like 30 people in the crowd or there's 15 people behind, you know, lead card or whatever, it kind of does look like yikes.
Yeah.
But if you market in a way of where it's like, this is an intimate thing, it's a special thing if you're on the grounds and then everyone else just has to tune in, I think it could work.
I think the tough part.
I'm on the fence now.
The toughest part about that, especially if we're talking in a major setting, for like a pro tour or even a silver series, 400 spectators allowed, that's fine. My opinion. Like that, for a silver series tournament, that level, not a big deal. Pro tour, you want more people to be able to come than 400. Obviously, and then a major, you want unlimited amounts of people to be there. Like, you want the fairways to be able to be lined. I think a big part of it is the amount of emotion that can be injected into an event via the spectators. Greatest example that
I'm with you on that with the majors. Yeah. I think I'm agreeing with you that you should try to have as many people as possible.
Because I think that even goes to pro tours too, though, to a certain extent. Because, I don't know, because like the biggest thing I'm thinking of is the Paul's putt at USDGC. The amount of emotion that was shown by Paul didn't look cringy or weird in any way. It looked like an insanely epic sports moment. A lot of it was because of the crowd around. Like, it was a big moment. There was a lot of energy in there. I think that's why Paul reacted the way he did. Because if you look at previous winners, and Paul being one of those previous winners, dating back and back and back, those wins meant just as much to these players. You know, obviously this one meant a little bit different, but they meant just as much. But players sometimes wouldn't show as much emotion because the feeling inside was just as much, but it didn't have this like explosive moment where like you're standing in front of a crowd, the crowd's going crazy, you can go crazy. And so I think that you would lose a certain aspect there, even if it is just a pro tour, of like the moment might not feel as big even though it might be a massive moment if there's not enough people on the ground.
No, I completely agree with you. And, you know, maybe it works a little bit better with UFC because you have like a team, right? You have a corner.
Well, you're also beating someone up. Like, it's hard to be punching someone and not be in the moment. It's a little bit different when you're just throwing a frisbee at a basket.
No, I agree. I'm not saying it will be better.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is I'm open now to the idea of it, where I think before I was like closed-minded and being like, if a course can't handle people, spectators, sayonara. So
yeah, now it's tough because you have to, like, what you're saying is you have to find the line of where the decision needs to be made. Like, what are we prioritizing? Are we prioritizing coverage? Are we prioritizing player experience and tournament like score separation? Or are we prioritizing on ground experience for fans? Because right now in disc golf, there's not a lot of places that provide all three. There's very few places, if any, that provide all three. Because I think that the fans that were on the ground, very limited, had a good experience at W.R. Jackson. Issue is, not a lot to come. Player score separation course, 10 out of 10. Pretty much as good as you can do. Obviously, there's some holes that you could change, but that's on every course. It is what it is. But the score separation and how difficult it was for the top players, great course, exactly the type of thing we want. Coverage-wise, there were moments it was spotty.
I will say, they were telling people too to like to put their phones on airplane mode again.
Yeah, which, but I mean, there has been improvement because a few years back, that course just, you couldn't even, there was no live coverage. They couldn't do it. But
it is nuts though, because after me and Ezra's practice round, you know, we were talking about what was possible out there. And we thought for sure 12 under was going to get hit.
Yeah.
We figured that was probably going to be probably like the best round of the first day. In tournaments too, players get more comfortable. They start figuring out holes a little bit better. So it's not surprising that more kind of double digits kind of popped up throughout the round or through as the tournament kind of went on. But it is nutty to think that, I mean, what, Dickerson won at almost averaging 10 under? Did he win at 39 under?
39, yeah.
Yeah, so he almost averaged 10 under par on that course. And that's the nutty thing is, like, just going out there and shooting 10 under isn't that crazy to think about because there are three par fives. All three are gettable eagles, two of which you really want to have, like, an eagle chance. And there are a handful of, like, par threes mixed in there where it's like all you have to do is throw one okay shot and you'll have a look at birdie. So 10 under is not the craziest thing in the world, but like we were talking about earlier, if you're off a little bit,
yeah,
if you throw a bad shot, bogey and double bogey are on the table. And if you have, unfortunately, like an off day, you can shoot over par,
yeah,
or one or two under. So to think that, like, Dickerson, Calvin, who else was up there? Ricky, heck, Gavin was balling out. Like, to think that those guys were able to go out there consistently and shoot close to, you know, average 10 under, like, that's the nutty part about a course like that, is because I can see people go out and shoot like 12, 11, 3, 9 and be like, okay, that makes sense. But having four rounds like that, I didn't see that coming. So
yeah. Yeah.
Well, I mean, on a course like that.
I mean, to show how court rounds can go from one end to the other, Paul went one over and then 16 under the next day. Which 16 under, I mean, yeah. I don't think anyone thought that was possible, but I thought in my head coming into the tournament, 13 under was like the hot. Obviously, on a course, on a disc golf course, players can birdie pretty much every hole. It's just factoring it in. Which I did want to bring up one thing in regards to 16 under, because we talked about it on Grip Lock, so we won't go into, like, that round was obviously insane. But where is this at? Okay, so Paul texted me this because he noticed it and said that he thought it was wild. I haven't had a chance to look into it to confirm it. But his final round, 16 under, he was on a car with Dave Felberg and Nico LaCastro. Apparently, his best round, the best rated round, the Memorial 1132, Dave Felberg and Nico LaCastro on his card. His 18 under at Toboggan, Dave Felberg and Nico LaCastro on a card. And he said, and he thinks his 15 or 16, his 16 under at USDGC, Dave Felberg and Nico were also on his card. So I don't know where the conspiracy is with that, but in the chat, feel free to make one up because that's fascinating. But regardless, yeah, a course like that, there's so much separation. You even see a player like Adam Hammes, who date back to the last tournament that was here. It was in a playoff for the win. And this tournament, he was in like 80 some place. He was over par through like three rounds. That's just courses
the
like
last
that.
Last round, he shot 8 under.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's a course like that, that's incredible. That's great. I think that's great for disc golf because it constantly is challenging players and players have to be on their best. It's just tough to do that outside of the woods right now. And the woods aren't the best a lot of times for spectators or for coverage. Live coverage quality wise. So it's like it's a weird balance that someone's going to have to solve. And I don't know where the answer is.
The one thing I would say that course, and again, like, other people are going to, you know, jump on and maybe disagree, but I do, you know, we talk about, you know, courses need to continue to grow and continue to kind of figure out ways of challenging players. That course obviously is challenging in the sense of off the tee, hitting gaps, super challenging. And then for the most part, on most of the par fours, they do require like a good shot to get a birdie look. The greens on a lot of the holes, though, are pretty soft,
yeah,
as far as challenging. And so that's why I think you saw incredible putting stats,
yeah,
from a lot of different people. Because there was no fear of running putts from 50 feet, 60 feet.
That makes
sense. So I think something that could change a little bit. Because again, I think we all like the fact of seeing players go out there and shoot 10 under one day and then like 3 under the next and then maybe 2 over. Like the fact that you don't know what someone's going to do.
Yeah.
Versus like when guys are playing well, they're all consistently shooting in between 7 and 11 under. I think that's where trying to find certain spots to make holes a little bit trickier, to where players aren't just, okay, because there was a lot of holes where it's, if you were in trouble, you literally were either throwing it just as far as you could or like throwing like a forehand roller and just trying to get as far down as possible without any worry of like, oh, this might roll out of bounds or there's trouble over here. And so figuring out ways of just continuing to make even the upshots of, okay, you threw a great drive. How do we make it to where instead of having this like 60-foot radius around the basket of where anything in this 60-foot radius is good, how do we make it to where let's cut that to half? Let's make that 60-foot rate, that, you know, that full pie, let's make that half a pie. And if you land in this half a pie, you're rewarded with a good putt. If you're laying in this other half a pie, you're not rewarded. And so I think those are ways of making that course more difficult in the sense of, in a fair way of where now when you have that 250-foot approach shot, yes, you still have to hit that gap in shot shape, but now you also have to worry about what your disc is doing at the bottom. Mm. A perfect example is like hole 15. I don't know if you remember that hole, but it was like a dog leg to the right off.
Yeah. Yep.
And then it was a blind shot up. And then like heavily down.
Yeah.
And then there's like a little bank with a creek at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
I threw a great drive, got to the top of the hill the final day. And I just told myself, like, don't be short. You literally have a back wall back there to stop the disc. Just don't be short. So I just like chucked a putter down there and it just slammed into the back wall basically. And it left me like a 25 footer for birdie. So I think if you make that creek OB and beyond, now, as I'm throwing that upshot, I have to be conscious of that, especially if you put like a drop zone too. That's the other thing. But I'll stop talking about course design and whatnot. But I do think that was the most fair wooded course on tour that I've played. I haven't played all of them, but that was definitely the most fair wooded course. There was literally maybe 3 or 4 trees on the entire course that might be like, hey, that would be kind of cool if that one went away, because that's kind of right in the middle of the fairway. But outside of that, it's like, you saw, if you were throwing the disc well, you scored great. If you were throwing the disc bad, you scored bad.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's a great course overall. So obviously, one of the biggest topics that's come out of this since the tournament has ended is this whole situation with Chris and Tatar's daughter. And I think that the reason it became such a big deal is mainly because the way the information got out was very slow and it came from multiple different places. And so a lot of people are just extremely misinformed on what all went down. And so people are getting mad at different people when it seems like there's a lot of questions surrounding the scenario, obviously, and not all the answers are out there yet. But a lot of them are. So I first want to just kind of cover as many details as I've been able to find from multiple different places so that hopefully everyone listening can understand kind of what all went down and the sequence of events that went down and how it all makes sense. And then we can kind of talk from there because I think there's still a few questionable things that we can just kind of reason through and figure out. So essentially, the rule that is brought into question is caddies basically have to be 13 and up, 13 years and older. Kristen's daughter is below that age and was wearing a caddy badge and walking with her on the final day. From everywhere I can find, it doesn't seem like she was walking with her in a caddy, like with a caddy badge in the previous days. So that's why it happened on the final day and not the previous days. So
I remember seeing her out there.
She was with her
practice round.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember seeing her out there during practice rounds. I don't know as far as tournament rounds.
Yeah, I don't know where the line or what separates it, because like from what I've heard is like she was with her during those first three rounds, but not in like a caddy aspect, which is what crossed the line essentially.
let me give you a little backstory too, to give a little information kind of leading into this, because this might actually help. I know you've dug into the details on the situation. I'm going to let you talk about that because I actually don't know. So I definitely want to be informed. But we were told that basically the PDGA is going to be cracking down on a lot of things leading into this tournament. One of which were, like, for example, like the dogs. Like, dogs on courses have been very, very, very lenient on, like, do whatever you want, bring your dog out on courses. Not during tournament rounds. Obviously, everyone knows that. But, like, practice rounds, people would just bring their dogs out. At IDGC, they were, like, no dogs. And so that was, like, a big kind of topic to some players. And I think in the past, people would just, like, ignore it and still bring their dogs. But it seemed like the PGA was kind of cracking down and being like, no. And it makes sense because, especially, like, we go to a different venue, we are a guest at that venue and we want to be invited back to that venue. And we can't really be going in and not doing what they're asking as far as rules go. The other thing they said they were going to crack down on, which I think they should, is who's allowed inside the ropes. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very adamant that the only people that are going to be inside the ropes is players and a caddy for each player, and that's it. The other people are media, like UDIS volunteer, score reporter, but no one else is allowed inside the ropes, and they're very adamant about that going in. And then, obviously, the other thing that they stressed heavily was time, like how long it takes you to throw. And they said, I think I didn't see it as far as, like, someone did come up to me and asked me about during my round, asked me how the spotters were doing. Cause some of the spotters were, like, not letting you throw on par fours, even though
we saw that on coverage some. Yeah.
Yeah. Other people were, like, putting out and they were still holding people. So that was an issue. But I do believe they had, Jeff Spring was one of the marshals as well. I think they had a couple marshals walking around and making sure there weren't big gaps in between groups. But, like, I think the first day, I think we had, like, a hole and a half gap behind us, and we were just riding the person, the group in front of us. So I don't know how enforced that time was, but I know that this was something that they had brought up to all the players leading into it of, like, hey, these are things that we're going to be cracking down on. So I just want to give that as, like, it wasn't just, you know, we kind of came in here and we were just, like, willy-nilly, like, what the heck's going on?
Yeah. No, that definitely provides some added context for sure. So the first thing that there's a lot of confusion on was, it was in Kristen's post, which initially came out, she said middle of the round, because it did happen during the round. I think that's what she meant by it. But obviously a lot of people took that to be, like, hole nine or after. Everything that I can find is, like, it was between, like, hole three and five that the text came in and all of that. So it seems like the whole ordeal situation was started by a text from Elaine King. And from Paige Pierce's interview on the Nick and Matt show, it seems like Elaine tried reaching out to Kristen, but obviously a player doesn't have their might not always be checking their phone. And also eventually reached out to one of her friends, who is Paige's caddy. I believe her name's Haley. Haley also didn't check her phone. And so then Elaine reached out to the president of the PDGA, but it seems that Elaine didn't want any officials to know what was going on with, like, a under 13-year-old being a caddy, because she was worried about a possible disqualification. The TD has since multiple times said that was never on the table. No one on my staff ever thought about issuing a warning or a disqualification. The worst that would have come of this situation was a warning. Disqualification was not on the table. I think the reason Elaine King thought it might have been, or it was ever brought up, was it dates back to a situation with Valerie Jenkins years ago, where she had a caddy that broke a code of conduct. And the rules are very clear that if you have a caddy, you and the caddy are treated as one. So if your caddy breaks a rule that gets you disqualified, you are disqualified. So it was a similar situation in that it was a caddy, but not really, because this caddy was breaking a rule of the code of conduct that would have gotten, if Valerie Jenkins would have done it, she would have been disqualified. And so it got them disqualified. This rule, there's not really a penalty in the rule book. So realistically, that's where the whole disqualification confusion came in. The TD and the PDGA.
There's no...
Yeah.
just clarify, there's nothing in the rule book that says like if your caddy is not of age, you get disqualified.
Correct. Basically. Next to this rule, and there's no penalty listed.
And then can you explain, do you have any information on why she was even allowed inside the ropes to begin with?
So that's obviously there's a few things that are questions surrounding it. A, why was, like, this should have been called on hole one, realistically, before the tournament, though, everything started. Because, yeah. Like, I guess there wasn't a screening thing. Maybe, I don't know if, like, every player just got a caddy badge and you could give it to who you wanted and it wasn't checked. But,
I mean, they had PDGA people there.
It also could have been a scenario of no one's really saying anything, no one cared type of ordeal, which is wrong.
I think that's
wrong.
Yeah, I think that's where the biggest outrage is probably coming from. I got to read a couple comments kind of on her Instagram and a couple comments I saw on some of the Facebook posts about it. I think that's kind of the biggest issue right now with the PDGA is like the consistency, right? And just being consistent. Like, I think people would respect more if you maybe were punishing someone or multiple people for a rule that might be dumb. But if you were doing it consistently to everyone that was breaking that rule, I think that comes off a lot better than like handpicking or choosing.
Yeah.
And it seems like in this situation, they kind of wanted to do like the back seat and like not be the bad guy and not do anything. And then their hand was almost kind of forced.
Yeah.
It sounds like is what I'm getting at. And then at that point, now it's kind of like, well, if you did that, you know, then I see all the other people talking about, well, this person has a caddy and they don't do anything. And the problem right now the PDGA has is when they classify caddy, it can literally be anyone. There is nothing that person needs to actually perform. Where
Correct.
On the PGA Tour, to be a caddy on the PGA Tour, even the Korn Ferry Tour, to be a caddy, you have to carry the bag.
Yeah.
Like that is part of the job. And so if you're not carrying the bag, you are not a caddy.
Yeah.
And I think that's the issue right now is I think some people are also seeing, you know, significant others just inside the ropes and they're just kind of walking around not actually being a caddy.
They're a caddy, but not really. They have a caddy badge,
yeah,
but it's nothing beyond that.
It's kind of, yeah. And it is, I don't know how much. You can finish the story and then we can kind of go into what I think of all this.
Yeah. So we're at, in Paige's memory, this is between hole 4 and 5, that her caddy is approached by the president of the PDGA, Joe. And basically Joe just tells her caddy, hey, Elaine King said you need to check your phone. And so then she checks her phone. On there, Elaine had texted her and said, Kristen's daughter, this is a summary, this isn't the direct quote, but essentially, Kristen's daughter's too young to caddy. Someone needs to notify her. It could result in a disqualification. That's basically the gist of the information that's in the text. Paige's caddy walks over to Kristen, shows her the text, basically saying, like, because she said she didn't want to be the one to, like, just say it because it didn't want to come across with, like, I'm with Paige and we're threatening you with this. She just wanted it to be like, hey, this is what Elaine sent me. And then it seems as though after that, Kristen called her partner Silver. Silver was warming up for his round, talked to the assistant TD, who eventually told the TD, Robert Leonard. And then Robert Leonard solved the whole situation by basically making Kristen's daughter a volunteer that's holding the quiet sign so that she's in front of all the gallery, but is removed from the caddy position so that basically Kristen could see her daughter the whole round and be able to make sure she's okay, but her daughter's also under adult supervision as the rules state, so that she's separated from her mom, but not really. Obviously, that's still an uncomfortable situation for, I believe she's 9, a 9-year-old in a foreign country, for your mom to have to be like, hey, everything's gonna be okay, but I need you to go with this stranger. You're gonna be able to watch me, but you're just gonna be a little bit farther back from me. Like, obviously, that's still an uncomfortable situation, and it could have been, it obviously could have been something that got into Kristen's head. It did also, though, happen early in the rounds. So you have to remember that. And I think that the way, once it was brought to Robert Leonard's attention, the TD's attention, if this is the first he heard of it, which from everything I've seen, it is, I think the way he handled it, the immediate solution he was able to figure out was the best case scenario that was within the rules as the rules are stated, because at the end of the day, that rule was broken, and so the PDGA's hand was forced, and they had to do something. The questions that are surrounding this all, obviously, one, why did Elaine King text from the booth as a commentator? That's one that's it's still going to be a question no matter what. As far as I've had a few interactions with Elaine King in general, I've also know a lot of people that know her. I think this was a well-intended move that was just very poorly executed, where like I think that in her heart she was trying to help Kristen, but like texting the competitor's caddy, obviously when the news broke that that's the exchange that went down, like everyone I think had a similar thought to me, which was like, why the heck are you texting the only competitor that Kristen's going head to head with, caddy, about something that at the time we thought could be a disqualification? Like, that just seemed weird. Again, stepping back from the situation, I think she reached out to Kristen first. It sounds like Kristen obviously didn't have her phone, so then she reached out to the person who she was also close to that wasn't an official, I think is the key, because in Elaine's head, she's worried about Kristen getting disqualified. And so Paige actually called the president of the PDGA, asked him, and apparently the text he received from Elaine, literally all the information in it was, I need you to get Paige's caddy to check her phone. Because, again, I think Elaine didn't want to tell any officials that could disqualify Kristen what was going on, because she was worried about Kristen getting disqualified. So I think the intention of Elaine was good, but it is a weird, it's weird on a few different fronts. One, someone on the board of directors of the PDGA being a commentator for PDGA events. I think that's a weird, that could cause weird conflict of interest situations.
I didn't think about that.
Yeah. Two, a commentator ever texting a player or a caddy during an event to alert them of something, because obviously this was good intentions, but what if it wasn't? What if this was a situation where it was a malicious intent and she's texting her saying, hey, here's something you can use.
Or what if it's a situation where it's like, I'm just throwing random scenarios out there. Say it's like Nate Sexton, mm-hmm. right? When he's in the booth.
Yeah.
What if he texts Big Germ when Big Germ's on the course saying, hey, we've been seeing everyone coming up short on hole six.
Yeah.
You can't feel the headwind up there. So it sets a precedent of like, if you're commentating, you're removing yourself from the event.
Yes.
And that is what you're doing. You shouldn't be interacting with players while they're playing.
Yes, exactly. And so,
I think that's a no-brainer. I don't think anyone is going to disagree with that.
No,
I think everyone knows that's what should happen.
Yeah, and I think so. Essentially, because the way the information came out, the order of it, because that's pretty much all the details, I think went over everything, but the way the information essentially came out is Kristen made a post, and in her post, she was just talking about, because this was obviously something that affected Kristen because it's her daughter, and it was a weird situation, and her daughter's in a foreign country. And I think in the post, the purpose of that paragraph that she put in about her daughter was literally to talk about how proud she was of her daughter being brave in that scenario, because it, again, in a foreign country, having to go with a stranger, having to even be separated from your mom, where you, even if it is only 30, 40 feet, that's an uncomfortable situation when you're in a foreign country. So I think that part, she just didn't cross her mind this is going to blow up. So that's the only tidbit of information the public got. And it was like, whoa, the PDGA separated her daughter from her. And then the next part of information that eventually came out was through UltiWorld, where they were trying to provide more information, answer more questions. And that's where the next tidbit of information that maybe everyone go, what the heck's going on, was the Elaine text to Paige's caddy was in that article. And that was the only context to that at that time. And that was, again, on a whole different platform. So now you have to go two places. And so then once you read that, though, there's no more details to what the text said, what was the intent behind the text, or were more people contacted. None of that's in that paragraph. So then you read that and you immediately, like I did, think that's malicious intent. Like what? Why is a commentator texting someone something that could get someone disqualified when, again, it couldn't have got her disqualified per the TD? And then farther on, you read tons of Facebook comments, Twitter threads, listen to Paige's interview.
How does Elaine not know that rule?
Well, I think, again, there's no, like, the only person that can disqualify someone is the TD, and there's no actual penalty for the rule. Like, it's a new rule this year. There's no penalty directly associated with that rule.
So she's okay.
Yeah, because, again, okay, the precedent sense. That was set was you can be disqualified because of caddies, because you go back to the Valerie Jenkins situation. So I think it was just like we've seen someone get disqualified before. I think this is a situation that could cause problems. But yeah, wild situation on a bunch of fronts. And I think back to what you were saying on consistency, because also weird. So this is from something on coverage with a caddy, right? And I don't want to directly call this person out because they probably didn't know, but I have to in this scenario, right? Is we're talking about the rule of the caddy. Caddies directly have to match the dress code that players have and so on and so forth. They basically have to carry themselves as a player in all aspects except for having to be a PDGA member and certified official at a major. So that means they have to have like dry fits, polo type shirts, stuff like that. Like they have to match a dress code. We saw Gavin Babcock's, I actually mentioned it on the companion stream because I found it funny. He was just wearing like a cotton t-shirt that said, "Hey, I'm Matt." And then on the back was just a printed picture of himself. Funny shirt. Like, it got a laugh of me on the companion stream. But like, if we're going to have a like text or something go out where we're calling out a caddy who's a 9-year-old for breaking that, and then we're going to let the lead card to MPO have a caddy who's breaking the rule that's two lines up from it, that's where that consistency kind of comes in. That has outraged people, right? Because like, one, why are we singling out this when I'm sure there was, that's only on coverage, I'm sure there's plenty of other caddies out there that were breaking weird caddy rules, because whoever really looks at a caddy rule,
there was also probably people breaking the only having your caddy with you.
And yeah.
Everyone else has to be spectators. Yeah. I'm sure there was people having multiple people.
And so I think that there is a few different, you know, I see the reason for the rule of the 13 and under. It's a weird one because like, isn't Kristen her adult supervision? You know,
it's not
weird line.
It's not a weird,
no,
a weird rule,
but
it's an obvious
rule. I agree. And the line has to be drawn somewhere.
Very,
yeah.
13, I would say, is also an aggressive line.
I think it's like, because like you can have touring pros who are 16, like Gannon. So if you draw the line to one way or the other, it's going to be weird because like,
yeah,
if you drew it at 18, then like, sure. Does Gannon have to have a adult supervision when he's playing his rounds?
It makes sense, yeah. Of where it's like he can't have a friend be on the bag, yeah. Because his all his friends are under the age limit. But
yeah.
Yeah.
The line has to be drawn somewhere, and so they decided at 13.
It'll also eventually probably be a line of how old you have to be to even make it into the Disc Golf Pro Tour. Like,
yeah.
There'll probably be a line of where like you can't play in the NBA when you're 16.
Yeah. But like I think a step that could have prevented this would have been like a caddy check of some sort, where like when you sign up, you have to put your caddy information in or something along those lines to where
they at least
have that.
Yeah. The issue with that though is people, including myself, like change caddies throughout the week. Cause again, it's one of those situations.
Maybe it's something that like before you tee off, you have to let the person at the tee know, yeah, this is my caddy for the round.
Or actually have like a check-in, like have like a, like you said, like have like a 10 minutes before you tee off, have like a quick little check-in of like what's going on. Because again, yeah, we're not in the stages right now of, well, I also don't know. Like, I think you can tell when someone is 10 years old and when someone's 25. So, you know, it's like someone going and, you know, trying to buy a alcohol at the gas station.
Well, it's also if someone looks like they're younger than 13, you just ask the question. Like that's pretty, yeah, simple. Like you're obviously a young teen, how old your caddy, just to make sure before you get your round started. But it should, right now, people might not even know who the caddies are. I think that's an important thing too, of make sure your caddy badge is visible and then check in with the marshal before he sends you off. What?
Bibs would be sick.
That's good too. But like something where it's obvious before everyone goes out. Yeah. Yeah. Bibs would work well.
That'd be sick. But did you have anything else on this? Because I wanted to add a couple things.
No, I think I got all the details out. So hopefully that clarifies any questions about how the situation was handled and why everything went down the way it did. Hopefully that clarifies all that stuff. If it doesn't, I'm sure we can look at the chat in a second too, but we'll let you throw in some more stuff here.
Yeah. So I think we're in this weird like spot right now with disc golf of how things are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so changes are happening. I want to bring up a video that I saw because I actually didn't know this and I thought this was fascinating. It didn't look that long ago, maybe in the 50s, maybe in the 60s, not 60s, maybe. We're going to say in between the 20s and the 50s, sometime in there. Not sure exactly the date on it, but at the end of golf tournaments, spectators, did you see this video?
Yeah, I did.
Spectators were diving. Like the person makes the putt, it's like 4 feet. Perfect person makes the putt, doesn't even go after it because spectators are diving in afterwards to try to get the winning ball.
Yeah.
Like that was a common thing at golf tournaments is fans would try to dive in and get the ball out of the cup. Clearly, times have changed and that doesn't happen anymore. And I just think that drastic like comparison between how the end of a tournament happens at golf now, where spectators aren't even on the green or on the fringe of the green or around the green. They're in the stands and they're separated and all that. I think that just kind of shows that as disc golf continues to grow, things are going to have to change. Mm-hmm. And one of those things are going to be like, who's allowed as your caddy? And they probably should need to carry your bag or else it just kind of looks like your girlfriend or wife or husband or whatever is just tagging along. And again, from what the PDGA stressed to us prior to the tournament was professionalism, professionalism, professionalism. I don't know if that looks professional to have just a significant other or a friend just tag along and not actually be your caddy.
Well, it's not. Yeah. It's also the line of like when you have a caddy carrying your bag and they're like, clearly executing the duties of a caddy, like walking through shots and stuff, even if it is just carrying your bag, it connects them to you to where you don't have to worry necessarily as much of your caddies like talking to other people. Because that's something that Paige said was one of the things, she didn't know what was going on yet. And Joe walked up, said that to her caddy. Her caddy checked her phone. Paige walked away and threw, and she turned around. Her caddy's talking to Kristen. And she said immediately, she's like, I don't even I don't want my caddy to talk to me during a round unless I talk to them first to make sure that I'm in a headspace where I want to be get information from them. I don't want them just offering information. I really don't want them talking to my competitors. Like, that doesn't make any sense. That's a line in Paige's mind. That's a line that shouldn't be crossed. And I think that line's a lot more easily crossed when you're just like, you know, if I showed up to a tournament and you gave me a caddy badge and I'm not carrying your bag and I'm just chilling, it's going to be a lot easier for me just to, oh, well, Brody's off throwing a shot. I'm going to walk up and say what's up to Ezra right here.
Yeah.
Because I'm just in the ropes. But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's that aspect of it, too, of just better clarification on things and then obviously just continue to improve because 5 years ago, if this was brought up 5 years ago, people would think we were insane to be saying, like, who cares? But as the sport grows and stuff, things have to change. And I think this is definitely one of those things that probably needs to be addressed more. And again, I think it's one of those weird situations where, you know, this is the PDGA's major, right? So they are the ones calling the shots and running it. And I think for it to really get the respect that they want, you got to sometimes be the bad guy and that's okay. You have to be the one to put your foot down and say, guys, we need to be following these rules. And there has to be some sort of consequence for not following the rules or people are going to continue to break the rules and hopefully A, not get caught or B, put people in a position. Cause I think that is the worst thing out of everything is when someone knows they're breaking the rule and they basically are going off the fact of like, this is going to put people in a really awkward position to have to call me on this. And I'm just betting on the fact that they're not going to call me on it. I think that's the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So until the PDGA, like puts their foot down, and even the Disc Golf Pro Tour, honestly, with some things, until they start putting their foot down and being like, this is what's happening, and if you don't abide by this, I personally don't, I mean, obviously strokes, I think, is the way to do it for like on-course stuff of like cheating or misplays or whatever it may be. But I think all this like kind of off-course stuff or whatever it may be, obviously warnings, sure, I guess, or having a system of some kind of like the first is a war, I don't know. But at some point there needs to be some sort of consequence or, you know, it's we're not going to see improvement. So I don't know. When I heard the whole situation after hearing it from you, like obviously it's a weird one.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you know, I think a bunch of people kind of did stuff that probably if they could go back, they probably would do it differently. You know, where it's like Elaine King probably shouldn't have sent the text. Kristen probably should have known that she can't have a caddy under the age of 13. All these things kind of would have been able to figure themselves out. But yeah, it's a weird one for sure. But it is crazy that, again, like disc golf media and stuff, like things are starting to get more and more popular now of where like if Kristen Tatar posts something on Instagram, word gets around, people start talking, and then all of a sudden stories start breaking.
Yeah.
Where, again, you go 5 years back, I don't think everyone's paying that much attention to people on social media. So people are probably posting stuff and you just don't. No one's really talking about it.
Well, I think it's also
crazy.
It's somewhat of a wake up call too. To well, in this case, I guess a little bit to PDGA of the importance of like getting a handle on a situation quickly, because this one got out of hand mainly because not all the information was immediately presented in a you know everywhere type of a way. It's still like there was never like a press release. They worked with UltiWorld on writing the article, but to be honest with you, I think the UltiWorld article, where it was like well written and provided details, they just didn't think that the detail of Elaine texting Paige's caddy was going to be something people got hung up on, and then like that immediately just changed the whole narrative of what people were upset about, to where like it almost made things worse instead of better in a lot of ways. Whereas if there would have just been a one stop, like we send it to UltiWorld, we send out a press release to all the podcasts, we post it on our blog, just widespread, we get in control of the narrative, we send it out of like, this is what happened, this is all the details, this is exactly how it was handled, this is why it was handled this way, this is the rule that was broken, and this is why we decided to do what we did. Boom. It's all nipped in the bud. Because a lot of people immediately, and honestly, rightfully so. Is that not it?
Bud?
Nipped in the bud?
I think it's nipped in the butt.
Is it butt? I don't know.
I think it's butt. You say bud.
I say bud, nipped in the bud. That's what I've always heard.
Like a flower bud? Like a flower bud?
Yeah. Silas.
I feel like I've heard bud.
Silas has heard bud.
Yeah.
What?
All right,
it's
Silas.
Nipped in the butt.
Google that thing while I'm talking.
Oh, we got people commenting right now that all say bud.
Bud, so. Nipped in the bud. All right, you Google it. But essentially,
what the heck does that even mean?
They could have put a stop to it before it ever got going. Because like the way it was presented initially, which was just one line in or a paragraph in Kristen's post, it seemed like the PDGA was a lot more at wrong than they really were at the end of the day. And it seemed like the way they acted was a lot worse than it really was at the end of the day, because the solution.
Seems like another situation that happened at Worlds last year. Very similar. Where it's like a situation that could have been handled a lot differently and no one would have cared about it. But
it's just something where PR wasn't something super needed, you know, years ago, because it was just like, You trust, like, no one's gonna say what's on their mind or whatever. I don't know, but like nowadays, if something happens and you feel yourself losing control, you need to get back control as the governing body, because especially in this case, like, I gained some respect for Robert Leonard and the actions they took after I understood what happened of how they, because they could have warned Kristen and said, Kristen, you need to solve this, and warned her and just left it. But they quickly were like, hey, the rule was broken. You know, it is what it is. We're going to allow your daughter to be a volunteer right up front under adult supervision, where you can also turn around and see her the entire round. She can see you. If she needs you, she's right there.
That's pretty nice. Yeah. They didn't have to do that. They could have literally been like, sorry, like you should have known the rule and figured out what to do with your daughter type of thing.
That's what I'm saying.
It's kind of the same thing. Like if you bring your dog, thinking that your dog, you could walk your dog while you play at a major championship, they're not going to be responsible to be like, oh, well, we'll have someone watch your dog for you while you're playing.
Yeah.
So
That's what I'm saying. It's like, but people.
Saz, we have a consensus of this saying.
Yeah, I Googled it. It says it's bud.
B-U-D. There you go. Nip in the bud.
It's bud.
Boom. Wow.
Now you know.
My mom has.
Led you astray?
Ruined my childhood. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating.
It was nipped in the bud.
Nipped in the bud. It's a fascinating.
It's like a flower. It's
fascinating,
like gardening. You nip it.
Oh, yeah.
The bud of the flower, right?
That's and you like get it the, stopped before it ever starts like, blooming.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. Yeah. That makes perfect sense.
To me, it's like nipped in the butt. Like someone's like at your butt and you're like, ooh, hey.
Well, that doesn't stop you before you ever get going. Cutting the bud off a flower, it can never bloom.
It gets you going.
There you go.
But this is to stop something from getting going.
This is to stop. Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, so that's that whole story.
Your reasoning makes a lot more sense than mine. So
that's that whole situation, right, well, and there's a lot around it. But hopefully, all the details make sense. And then, I think it's something that a lot of people will learn from and move forward. And final thing on it, a lot of respect to Kristen because she did eventually edit her post once she realized it was getting out of hand and took full responsibility of like, hey, as a competitor, at the end of the day, it's on me. I should have known that rule walking into the tournament, and I didn't. And that's true too. It's like competitors, they need to know the rules they're abiding by, and that goes for their caddies and everything they're bringing with them. And it's a weird one, and it's a new rule as far as I understand as well. So it's something that she just didn't know, and it, luckily it all kind of worked out. But yeah, it was unfortunate.
And again, it goes back to what we kind of were talking about of where disc golf is in this weird changing mode of where if you made it into any other professional sport that was established for years and years, you would probably be terrified to go in and like break a rule. So you would probably really make sure that you knew what you're doing.
Yeah.
Where in disc golf's been so lax, and we see rules broken all the time and no one caring. And so it's going to be a really weird period of time of where like stuff is going to get fixed and enforced, and players are going to have to adjust and figure it out.
Now back to the
I've broken a bunch of rules and
yeah. Back to the like warning punishment line thing, because obviously it's a weird one to transition into because you don't want to go straight to like monetary fines because there's such a disparity of like $200 fine is a lot of things to some disc golfers, but then $200 fine is nothing to some disc golfers. Someone suggested though.
That can be said also for like UFC fighters, for PGA Tour players.
Well, yeah, no, it's true for a lot of sports.
Yeah, Conor McGregor getting fined $20,000. He's like, whatever. But you've got like, one of the bottom guys in the UFC getting fined $20,000. That's how much they make a fight. So
yeah.
It's like,
but I mean, the figure there is at least big enough that Conor McGregor, even though it doesn't hurt him, it's a lot different than if Conor McGregor was fined $200.
No.
Do you think $20,000 doesn't hurt? Like, I mean, it's different no matter what.
Do you know how much money Conor McGregor has?
Well, I'm sure like even Elon Musk, he's going to know there's a difference between $200 and $20,000. Like,
I don't think you know how much $1 billion is.
I do. They don't notice it in their bank account, but like, they obviously get the difference between $200,000 and $20,000. That's how they got to get $1 billion.
I know, but have you seen like NFL players purposely break rules and know they're going to get fined because they're like, I want to do this and I don't care?
It's like that time Mark Cuban got fined $15,000 for saying the F word, and he found out it was going to charity, and so he just said the F word again. He said, well, F it. And so he could donate 30 to charity like that. I get that, but I'm just saying in disc golf, it's a little bit different. Yeah. So someone suggested though, possibly, cause obviously like you're saying strokes during a round, someone suggested, pro tour
Banks.
Points. No.
Oh,
pro tour points findings. So like you could get fined a certain amount of points. Maybe like the first one's just a little warning. It is what it is. Second one, you get fined a little bit. Third one, you get fined a lot. So then, like, it could be the difference of you getting to the Pro Tour finale and getting that immediate $2,000 paycheck or not make, like, missing the cut or it being harder for you to make the cut type thing.
That's interesting. Another one I just thought of, too, doesn't really make sense right now, but down the road, it could be something along the lines of, like, you drop in your priority for signing up for tournaments. Mm. So, you know, say that we end up having tournaments capped at 130 players and there's 200 players that have tour cards. You know, if you're sitting at that 120 level of where, you know, that's where you are on the priority, you're getting in pretty much at the very end. You mess up, they're like, all right, we're bumping you down to 140. Now you're kind of, you need 10 people not to play an event for you to get in. So, yeah, no, I think there's definitely different ways of doing it. It doesn't have to just be a monetary thing.
Yeah.
But those are probably definitely things that should be talked about on the PDGA side and the Disc Golf Pro Tour side. Because as this stuff gets bigger and bigger, more people are paying attention to it. The last thing you want is another kind of situation like this where something is done, something sees it. I think it'd be a lot worse. This luckily was on coverage, and luckily, like, all the information was able to kind of come out to where now I think for the gist, most people probably know what happened. But like, what goes on if like a Ram fan is watching someone and they're like filming them, and then they, you know, then they like post that, and now you only have like one side of the story. And
yeah, just fully out of context take. Yeah.
Yeah. Something to think about, but
yeah, because that happens in plenty of other sports too. Yeah.
It's all fascinating stuff.
It's just growing pain to disc golf. But
should we talk payouts real quick?
We can. I mean, I went into a rather long tangent on Grip Locked about them, so I'll keep my side short, but I'll let you kind of take the reins.
I figured you probably busted out your Excel spreadsheet over there. So yeah, go check out Grip Locked if you haven't already to get more of a breakdown on it. But I find this so fascinating that there are certain topics that to me just seems like, how could anyone think differently? And maybe we can get some people in the chat, or I don't know if we're taking calls tonight or whatever, but if you're listening or watching, maybe once our live ends, go over on the YouTube, comment down below like your thoughts, because I would love to read like more expanded stuff, because the stuff I saw on Twitter, it's shorter, and I think a lot of times people just aggressively tweet something and not really care about me trying to actually understand their point.
Yeah.
But I would love to see people that are on the other fence of this, because I don't actually understand how you could be. But like, what was the emphasis? Why was there so much emphasis on the bottom cash?
I don't know. Like, I'll never know.
That I've never understood that. Like, I know in certain sports that like if you make it to the playoffs or you get second place in a bowl game, whatever it may be. Like if you don't win, I know in other sports there's like other things that come with that, but that's never discussed. No one ever talks about
it. No, it's not promoted.
That aren't winning.
Doesn't make any
sense. Yeah, and so they didn't actually, as far as I'm concerned, I didn't see anything on Twitter and Instagram. It could be on different platforms, but I didn't see anything on Twitter or Instagram promoting what the winners were taking home.
No.
The only thing I ever saw numbers-wise was what the last cash was making. So,
and there was a four-way tie for last cash. So there were some three-figure checks written, which, I mean, that's just...
I saw that tweet. That's funny. That was a savage tweet. That's a funny tweet. I laughed when I saw that. But yeah, so I don't know who... Like, I don't know what side. I saw some being like, yeah, but this is, like, good for people that can't tour. But I don't get that argument either, because the people that are last cashing... Those type of people are also not cashing at other events.
Yeah.
So, like...
And then they're also coming in the top whatever, where, like, Corey Ellis and Gavin Babcock, where they're going to be rewarded with more money if you restructure it. So, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense.
I was just confused on, like, the emphasis on the bottom side.
Yeah, regardless of how the payout's distributed. Let's say the payout was distributed perfectly, and the last cash was $1,000, and it's like the first, and like it's what we decided, like, oh, that's sick, let's celebrate it. That still doesn't make sense. So I'm still confused by it. Even forget about the purse distribution, I'm still confused why we're ever being like, the person who lost to 39 people is taking home $1,000. Let's give it up. Like that, what? Let's, especially like
last cash was 18 under, so you lost by 21 strokes.
Yeah. And my thing too is, some people are saying it's to grow the sport. it's for the growth of the sport, not because the sport's grown, because that argument I can at least see, like, oh, the sport's grown, the purses have gotten bigger. It was like, no, it's to grow the sport. And I'm like, in my eyes, saying first place is taking home in the, at this tournament $13,000, even at just $13,000, because obviously it could have been restructured, that could have been 20 grand, at $13,000, in my eyes, that does more to grow the sport and get other eyes in than knowing last cash got $1,000. Because, like, what does that mean? To, like, no one's quitting their day job because they know if they come in 40th, they're getting $1,000. People might quit their day job when they see Nathan Queen win and get 30 grand. Like, that's a different thing.
Have I given the poker analogy, the friends poker analogy? Have you guys heard that, Silas? Do you
I've
remember
heard
me talking
it,
about that?
I don't know if you've done it on a show.
No.
Have I done that?
I think you just said it to like Trevor and I.
I don't know what you're talking about.
All right.
Let's hear it.
So real quick, you have seven buddies. Okay. You call them up. Hey guys, wife's out with friends, poker night. Your seven buddies come over, you all sit down at the round table, you start busting out the chips. What are we playing for tonight? Everyone's like, $5. All right, sweet. Everyone puts $5 in the pot. What's 8 times 5? Yes, that's $40. Okay, now you're trying to figure out how do we want to divvy up this money, right? I don't know about you, but if the winner's not taking home like $40 or $50,
well, there's only $40 in the pot. If the winner's not getting $10,
$10, $10 buy-in, $10 buy-in, so okay. $80 per. So if the winner's not taking home $50. If the winner's not taking home $50 out of 80, and you're doing this thing of like, okay, well, let's have fourth place get $10, and then fifth place get $15, and then 20th place gets $20, and you start like getting all that. What is that? What did I just do? 20-40? So that means first place gets $40 in that scenario. If you start making it to where like you're not really playing for that much, and again, this is obviously you see this more when the money is small, and that's where disc golf is right now. The purses aren't big enough. So when the purses aren't big enough, you see it a lot better when like last cash. And I think, Hunter, you gave the example that there's a bigger gap between not cashing and cashing and last cash and what was it, 14th place?
14th, yeah. There was like a $900 difference between 14th place and last cash. And there's a $1,000 difference between last cash and not cashing, which at a PGA Tour event, it was like, last cash got, this was at the Masters, I want to say, last cash got like 37,000. So not cashing was a 37,000 difference, and 14th place got 250,000. So the difference was like $213,000 versus 37,000. Obviously that's a much bigger scale, but.
Yeah. And again, we can end it on that. I just thought it was weird. I'd love to hear anyone's comments on why they think that emphasizing how much the last person to get money. I would love to hear that.
Well, also,
it's a dark horse strategy that no one else has thought of in other sports, and we're in groundbreaking territory here, and we're doing something special.
The question for me too, though, is like that move up, right? From 40th to 20th place is like, let's just call it $600. Y'all know what it actually was. I just know 14th was $900 some. So 20th place, we'll just call it like $600 some or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. If you're in 39th place and you're looking and you're like I was well out the top 20 stroke wise, but it's only a few $100 difference. Where's the motivation? Because like you don't get extra accolades for coming in 19th place. You might unlock a sponsorship bonus, but let's say 21st place where you don't now. There's no extra accolades. It's just the money difference.
I don't think that's the right way to think about it. I think everyone out there is motivated. Now, obviously there are some people, and we can go into this a little bit of why the heck are we not having cuts, especially at 4-day events.
Yeah.
And we maybe go into that, but I think for the most part, if you're in the mix, you're motivated to finish as high as possible. But I think it's when you are done, that's where it's like, you get hit with it. So I don't think there's anyone like on hole 17 being like,
I'm not saying
birdie this last hole. Yeah, if I birdie this last hole, wow, I move up a spot and I get what, $10 more? Whoop-de-doo. I don't think there's any of that going on.
No.
But it is one of those things of where it's like you come in, like you're saying, I'm in 40th place. I'm in last cash right now. You're coming in round four. I'm in last cash. And you're like, all right, $1,000. And then you don't look at any of the other places and you ball out of control and you move 23 spots. And then you look at how much money you made and it's like $1,550. And you're like, that's where it's like, wait, I made $550 more.
That's what I'm saying.
And I moved.
Yeah.
That's
it doesn't reward or motivate like that extra thing. Like you get there. And you get to what you feel is a peak, even like top five or top 10 at a major, and you're just thinking in your head, you have this different picture, but because of the way the purse is distributed and everyone's always talking about just the top, you're like in the middle mix where you're proud of yourself. You came in top 10 or whatever. And you're like, wait a minute, this is it. This is what I got. Like, it just seems weird. And you're like, last year I finished 20 spots lower and I got very similar money like that.
You want me to give you the perfect analogy,
Yeah.
You're at a fine dining Italian restaurant. Okay. You got the chicken parm. Your wife got the lasagna. Maybe you have a bottle of wine. You're eating salad. You got some breadsticks. Great meal. The check comes. You know it's going to be a big check. You're at a nice restaurant. Your wife ordered a nice bottle of wine. It's probably going to be like $150. Check comes. You pay your credit card. Put your credit card in there. Send it off. When it comes back and you open that up and there's no mint in there, it's like a huge letdown. Like, you're ready to have like some nice mints. And when there isn't any mints, you're just like, it leaves you with a bad taste in your mouth. And I feel like
literally,
that's what's happening here. Yeah, I think this is what's happening here is some people are being left with a bad taste in their mouth after shooting really well, thinking that they're like, wow, I just moved up a crap ton. And then they're looking at it and being like, oh, okay, that didn't really matter. So, all right, let's talk about cuts. What the heck are we doing? Why are we not having cuts? What is the reasoning behind not cutting people? Is it simply the fact of like, hey, we don't want to cut anyone because Brody booked his hotel through Sunday. And if he gets cut on Friday, like, what is he supposed to do? He has booked his hotel for two more days. Is that the reason?
The
argument is because we don't want to have that happen.
The argument I've heard.
Most of them have vans, right?
Good point, Silas. Argument I've heard previously.
Fair point, Silas.
Argument I've heard previously was along the lines of basically like there was a group of touring pros that only made up a certain percentage of the field. And so you had like Ledgestone, for example, a pro tour event, and there was another group of people that traveled in to play the event, or even majors traveled in to play the event, and you're cutting their experience short because back then you wanted those people to show up because it filled the field out. That reasoning is gone away, more or less. Really, you have a full tour, a full field that is touring the country now, and cuts or no cuts, you don't have to worry nearly as much about Trevor and I not wanting to travel out and play at Idlewild and play in a pro tour event. We're like, we're not going to go though, because we know we're not making the cut. So now we're going to pay all this money for only 2 days. So at this point, I don't know fully the logic behind it. I think it is somewhat what you said of like players are in town, they're planning to be there 4 days. And I think it's also somewhat the players paid for 4 days. We feel like we owe them 4 days of experience, but when a tournament has a cut, it's way more exciting to me. Security.
Okay. There's another one that baffles me. So if there are people out there that have broken,
I think
the puzzle
are the previous arguments I've heard, but I don't think any of them are relevant anymore.
Yeah, because it's like no one on the pro tour should be on the pro tour if they're doing it for an experience. Like that, this is not people like what I'm just going to show up to some chemical engineering plant and be like, hey, I just want to be a chemical engineer for the day for the experience. I just want to experience what it's like to be a doctor. Like, this is people's jobs. And so I think it's like it goes back to that respect level. Like everyone that's coming, and again, like they're obviously it's not there yet to where we have a full list of you know 150, 200 touring pros that want to be in every event, and it's getting close actually because I'm seeing like the same names at literally every event. There's like only a handful of people that are like dark horse getting in, but like I just don't feel like that many people, if any, are playing on the pro tour right now and are doing it because it's for the experience, just for the experience, like going to Disney World, of where it's like, I know I'm going to spend $400 going to Disney World, but I'm going to have a great time doing it. So I feel like everyone on the pro tour should be trying to win. Like that's why you're playing in these events, is you're trying to challenge yourself to see how good you can do.
Yeah.
And if you don't have a good first 2 days, guess what? Sayonara, you're out. So I still haven't heard a good reasoning for that. I would love to be maybe we're missing something too. Maybe there is a dark horse reason out there that we're missing that someone can enlighten us on how they're doing it. Because at the end of the day too, if I'm 10 shots out of the cut at a course where you need to be shredding, the cut's not going to drop and I'm probably not going to be able to shred. Like I can't go out and shoot 20 under in a day. So like, aren't I still just going to sit around Saturday, Sunday? Like the only difference that changes is like I'm playing disc golf for 4 hours.
Yeah.
But I'm still paying for my hotel or like the hotel excuse of like they've already paid for the, but they're still paying for their hotel Saturday, Sunday and not making any money at the event.
Yeah. It basically just gives the people who would have barely missed the cut two more chances of cashing. Like those people like on that bubble. But if you know that going you have two rounds to make the cut, you can't be mad when you miss the cut.
I was also going to say it also sucks for the people that are above the bubble and then get passed. Like you got to think about both sides. It's good for the people underneath. Yeah, it gives them 2 days, but it also gives 2 days for the people that played well the first 2 days to not play well the next 2 days and miss the cut. So it goes both ways. But I would love to hear more. Okay, I got more stuff.
Okay, all right, let's keep rolling. Right,
I wrote this down in the shower. I was thinking stuff.
More shower thoughts, talk, of Brody.
can we talk about the white gloves? have you talked about the white gloves?
No, we haven't.
Can you pull up? Silas, I'm sending you a photo. Please, can you put this up on so people watching right now can see this?
Good luck, Silas.
What do you mean good luck?
Oh, Silas, pull it up on your computer screen.
Yeah, he can do this. What the heck?
He can do it. He can do it. I just solved it. He can do it.
Wait, isn't it in the group chat already?
I'm not sure.
Hold on. I gotta find this. I saw this.
While you're looking at it, I have a question. You might not know the answer. Were the white gloves used during the like presentation of the trophy to the winners?
No, you watched that. Yeah, you watched that. They weren't.
That's to say, I don't think they were.
The white gloves were not on when they were handing it to the winners. So, did I send that to someone?
I've seen
that. Where did I send that?
I've seen it.
No, I sent it to you. I think I just sent it to Hunter. You might send it to Trevor.
And
I don't have anything, Brody.
Hold on. I think I just sent it to Hunter and Trevor.
I got it right here. I'll send it to me. Silas, I'll airdrop it to you right now.
Okay, the first thing, I didn't win. Spoiler alert. So I did not to see the trophy in person. I will have to say, I will always appreciate the people that when I say anything about payouts and like cuts and stuff, I always appreciate the people that point out the obvious of like, bro, shouldn't you be like advocating for last cash? Cause that's what you're going to get. I'll always appreciate those comments. Okay.
The picture's up.
Is it up? The picture's up. People can see the situation.
Here's what I'll say about it.
I pull up YouTube. I got to see this.
Here's what I'll say about it. I respect what they're trying to do, which is create this trophy that is so illustrious and so prestigious that it's got to be handled with white gloves here.
I respect it.
Silas, that's enough, man. Come on. I respect it. I'll put it there. I respect the notion. I think that the issue is you typically see that with like the Stanley Cup or something where you're worried about getting fingerprints on it.
Fingerprints.
Yeah,
the World Series one. I can't remember what the name of it what the name of it is. Chris, what's the World Series trophy?
I don't know the name. Crap. I suck at baseball. I can Google it.
Maybe you can.
I can Google it.
I don't know.
We can take the picture down.
I wasn't thinking you would know what the thing was.
Commissioner's trophy.
Commissioner's trophy. Yeah. That thing. We actually got to like handle it as like we got like a weird thing that we could go into the room and whatnot. Like there was like three people constantly watching it. I also think that trophy is worth probably a lot of money too. So that also makes sense. So I agree with you, Hunter. I like the idea of like, hey, we're gonna do something. I think it missed just with the actual trophy. And then the other thing is like, it's to prohibit like fingerprints all over a trophy that when you see it in photos or when you see it on camera, you can see the fingerprints.
Yeah.
This trophy was, I think, either plastic or wood.
The base looked wooden. Yeah.
I'm testing it right now. I don't think you can see fingerprints on wood.
No.
To the naked eye.
Unless there's a lot of gloss. If there's a lot of gloss, you could.
Depends on the finish.
You could. That thing could have some serious gloss on it, yeah. And they're protecting it. But counterpoint, I think it was presented without the white gloves. Yeah. And the winners both handled it without white gloves too. So.
Well, that wasn't a big enough. That wasn't a big enough topic. I thought that was going to get memed. I thought people were going. I don't know, but I thought that was. I thought that was when I saw it.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the trophy speaks for itself with the chains and whatnot. But when I saw the white gloves, I lost.
I will say another thing that I really like the idea behind this trophy is it seems like the players went home with separate trophies. And this is like one of the first trophies in disc golf that is like staying as the Champions Cup and like names are going to be inscribed on going forward. That's not something we typically see. I think we've seen it at some, like USDGC has one. I don't think Worlds does, probably because of how much it rotates. A local C tier I played called Mookie's Cup.
The players?
Called Mookie's Cup, not yours, had it. Shout out to Mookie's Cup, not yours. That was the name of the tournament. Loved it. But regardless.
Do they not trust the players to bring them back?
I don't know. I mean, is that what happens in other sports?
Yeah. I mean, this happens in a lot of other sports.
So, like, what sport? So, I guess, like, the Stanley Cup. What do they get, though? Just the ring? Like.
No, you get the whole cup. What the heck? I'm pretty sure they get the whole cup.
Just for the year.
Yeah.
But, like, what do you get beyond the year? Beyond the year is what I'm saying.
Oh, like when they turn it back?
Yeah. Like what does the organization have other than just a banner and the players have rings?
Hockey is not my forte, so I'm not sure. Yeah. I do know a lot of sports do like the rings. Like
rings. Yeah. That's what USDGC did. USDGC, your name goes on the trophy. You get a trophy of sorts. I think it's normally like a glass bowl looking thing that's pretty cool. And you get the ring when you show back up the next year. They have like the ring ceremony for the previous year's winner, which I love. USDGC does it perfect. I love all of that. But again, idea was great. And respecting the trophy like that, love it. It did just look, it looked humorous.
Yeah, it did. It's different when you're holding like a $15,000-$25,000 trophy. And
yeah.
$150 trophy, which I don't know how that costs $150. All right. Last thing I want to talk about, and this is an interesting take on it.
Okay.
I've brought this up before, but I have another situation.
Another
where
spin. Let's hear it.
I think I could spin it to get some people on my side that aren't. The whole congratulating people and saying nice playing with you and all that stuff on the tee of 18.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Obviously I've made it known that I don't like that. I'm not a fan of it.
Yeah.
This is what I'll say. Okay. Obviously I've made all my points of why I don't like it. It's not over yet. You're like saying good job when there's a minute left in the game It makes a weird vibe, all that stuff. But let's spin it a different way.
Okay.
I think it gives the ability to have someone storm off after 18 because they've already said good playing with you, yada, yada, yada. So if they blow up on 18 and if they double bogey, triple bogey, miss a putt to miss cash, whatever ends up happening, if something happens to where it just implodes them. And also we've seen this too on hole 18 too, is like someone's having a bad round. They just like, will be like, yeah, 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 yeah. Right. And then as soon as they're done with the round, they just bolt.
Yeah.
And they're gone. If we made it to where you didn't do that, no one says anything on hole 18. Nothing's different than hole 17, 16, 15. It's all the same. And at the end, when the final putt is putted out, everyone, you know, you take your hat off or whatever. I think it's a sign of respect to take your hat off. But you take your hat off, shake everyone's hand, shake everyone's caddy's hand, and say, hey, it was great playing with you, great playing with you, great playing with you. And then you head off to the scorecard. I think as a spectator, obviously on a player side, it's one thing. But as a spectator too, I think that shows like a mutual respect to everyone. Then as a spectator, you see someone tap in and get frustrated and just storm off. You're like, that's weird. But then also I think too, as a player, it makes us have to play that professional role of where, hey, maybe we didn't have a good round. Hey, maybe it wasn't that funny out there today, but we still all know, like, we respect each other as athletes, as professionals. And it makes you not be able to just storm off and like lose your cool. And I think personally, that's an interesting spin on the whole idea. Thoughts?
I agree. I love it. I mean, I think it just shows, like, you have to be able to lose with grace or lose with, lose with grace. That's the phrase, right? Lose with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hear that.
Yeah. That's the phrase.
Especially in that situation, if we're talking about winning and losing, like, you could be up one going into 18. And be like, hey, great playing with you. Great playing with you because you're up by one. And then something terribly happens on 18. You lose. Like, you still want to see that person.
Yeah. Typically, the winner and loser, like, it's a known thing that, like, when the tournament's over and someone just won, people still walk up and tell them, like, congrats. You know, even the close competitor, like, typically that still happens. But in your scenario, like, yeah, you could still be like, what are you talking about? We said good game on the tee. Why would I go back up and say it a second time? Versus it just being, you know, the normal thing. It also is just like, that's the standard. Like, that's what everyone else does. Like, I remember multiple games in basketball where it sucked. We got our teeth kicked in or we lost, you know, a close game. But like you were saying, because of respect for the other team, you got
to
walk up and have your head up and shake the coach's hand and tell him great job and shake the guy you're guarding's hand and tell him, like, yeah, you got me this game. Or, you know, that's also when you see the true colors of some people. Like, sometimes you beat the team and you go to shake their hand and, like, the point guard or whoever who had an attitude all game isn't going to shake your hand. And you're like, all right, well, now I know you're just a jerk. Like, that makes sense.
I think it shows more true colors. I think that's an interesting, side that I didn't think about.
Yeah. It makes players be a little bit more it gives more opportunity for players to show true colors, sportsmanship, and professionalism on the course.
Some people wanted to talk about Paige consoling Kristen. I don't really have anything to say about that because I don't know how good they – I mean, I do see them practice a lot together. Like, they go out and have practice rounds together, so I'm assuming they're probably decently close friends.
Yeah.
I think that's a hard one to talk about on the outside without knowing their relationship. Because I know if it was me and that happened and I was in Kristen's situation, obviously I'm going to say, like, good job and everything like that. But the last thing I want is to have someone that just beat me come up to me and be like, hey, whatever. But again, like, their relationship, no, I don't know what the relationship is. So,
yeah, because, like, Kristen might have
done the same thing to Paige in a different tournament that Kristen bested her in. So it's tough to say. I think those situations, that's a situational thing.
Yeah.
Because you have to be able to read the situation of whether or not that person. I mean, I've even had teammates where I know, like, after a tough loss, like, you give them a 5 to 10 minutes to, like, to themselves, and then they're good. But if you come up to them right after the game, it's not good. So it's a situational thing of, yeah, of whether.
Yeah, that's just a lot of, like, you were saying, personal. Because, like, there's some people who, like, let's just say it's me in that those shoes, and I just lost, and it's someone who I have no relationship with just beat me, and they walk up and console me. Yeah, I'd be like, what the heck are you doing right now? Because, like, you're going to make me look like a jerk when I push you, because I'm about to. But if it's someone like you or Trevor or Silas or someone who, and we're in a major situation, we're going neck and neck, and you beat me, and I just lost, but we have a good relationship, we're friends, and you walk up and you're like, dude, you know, it was a tough one, you'll get me next time, that was still, what, blah, 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 you played really well, whatever. I'm going to accept that a lot differently because we have a relationship and I understand where you're coming from versus just a stranger. And I think that Paige and her do have that. Obviously, the way the coverage was shown, it looked like Kristen wanted no part of it, but you're sitting, you know, I'm sitting hundreds of miles away through a screen. You can't see. Kristen could have been just like thanking her and just, you know, her body language, she just lost a major. It's, you can't just read body language in an instant like that. And they do seem like they have a good friendship beyond all that. So it was most likely a well thought out thing that was probably well accepted on both ends. But yeah, Silas, is there any other conversations from the chat? Do you have anything else, Brody, that you wanted to bring up?
Sure.
That's all I got, man.
All right, let's get a few from the chat and then wrap it up.
All right. I nipped it
in the butt.
There you go.
Not that.
That means he got started, dude.
Yep, he got started. All right. We got one from John Gordy. This was actually the first debate topic in the chat. I wrote it down.
Great.
Here we go. He says, more horizontal Mando lines to prevent players from going over the top and crazy Simon lines, and instead throw the shots the course was designed for. Thoughts?
That's a super situational one, I think.
What do you mean?
Yeah, what?
Well, because there's some...
Like, W.R. Jackson didn't really have any holes. It's very course-dependent. Like, W.R. Jackson didn't have any holes that you could, quote-unquote, break. I think a hole that's going to be interesting for you guys to see is, like, hole 4.
I got one. Okay, you know that turnover, that backhand turnover shot? I think it's, like, hole 3?
Yeah, hole 3.
Okay.
Hole 3.
Yeah, so what if that was made so you couldn't go higher than a certain amount, so you had to throw the low forehand shot?
I went the high backhand all 4 days, and I was +2 on the hole. I didn't get a single birdie.
That's right. What I'm saying.
That was just fresh on my mind.
No, yeah, but that hole is like that. That's a very, very difficult shot to actually, like, I think he's talking about like breaking holes.
Yeah.
And hole four at Jonesboro is a perfect example. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go back and watch coverage at hole 4 at Jonesboro. Everyone, you can look at the hole and be like, oh, this is a sick hole. Low ceiling, 2 trees, got to punch it through. No one went that way. Everyone just juiced it out to the right, big like turnover, or even I think it was a hyzer, out into the field. And just played the hole out into the field. Now, obviously, there's a way that you can make them not do that is you can put like an OB line to entice people to go up the middle. But even with the OB line, people just throw something more overstable so that it comes back in bounds. But what they did this year, and you'll see the change. We actually just posted a YouTube video, so you can watch it now and see the change. They moved the tee box back and to the right. I like that more. Of like positioning the tee box. They did the same thing at Music City Open. One hole, clearly a shot that they wanted you to throw through a tunnel. People were like running off the back of the tee pad and like throwing sideways up and over like these crazy sky annies to just get away from the tunnel shot. Would they do this year to prohibit that? They moved the tee pad up 20 feet. So now you're in the tunnel and that shot is gone. I think moving tee pads to, if you can move tee pads to make it to where like a tree is now blocking that, or that shot isn't even available, I like that more because it still allows players to get creative of what type of shot they actually want to pull off in the actual shot that you're trying to get them to do, versus like making these horizontal mandos, and now you're prohibiting players from throwing different types of shots.
So we just need better course design.
Well, I think it's just, it's a super situational thing, because there's some holes where
very situational.
There's some holes where you designed it to be played as like a straight shot with a hyzer finish, mm-hmm. but there's this sneaky anhyzer gap way up top that's way riskier.
Yeah.
And like a hole like that, if someone executes that shot, yes, it breaks the hole, but it's a risk reward thing where a player could choose to, like, if you go down the middle and you hit the gap, you're getting it every time. If a player decides to go up over the top, it might be something where, like, yeah, if they hit it, it breaks the hole, but they're hitting it 10% of the time. So it's like safer for them to go down the middle. A hole like that, I think that's a kind of part of what makes disc golf exciting, because now you have like
risk reward.
Yeah.
You gotta have the risk, though. You gotta have the risk.
Yeah, if it's just a simple, like, if you clear this first gap, you're parked, or you're in the fairway, those are the holes where you adjust a tee pad, you put a mando in or something. But if it's like, there's a big risk, but, you know, if you hit it, you're rewarded, that's an exciting moment, because it also, down the stretch, allows for, like, a player to go down the middle and then, oh, he's trying the high left line. Like, if he pulls this off, he has a chance at an eagle. That's not really breaking the hole. That's just adding more excitement.
All right. Yeah. There you go, John.
All right.
Real quick, Brody, we had a super chat from Matrix370. Yeah. He wants to know, do you prefer concrete or turf tee pads?
I probably will say turf in the sense of just like wear and tear on the shoes. If it is nice turf and it's like leveled.
All right. There you go.
Boom.
All conditions, a good concrete pad, though, is probably going to be better, though, because turf can get real slick when it's wet.
Boom. Next one we have from Phoenix Delaney. They say, we need to hire commentators and teach them disc golf, not have disc golfers commentating.
I think disc golfers need to commentate the color role, which is the analytic, give us more detail.
How was it? I didn't listen to any of it.
It was the same. Lots of room for improvement. Yeah.
No improvement at all from like the previous week.
Not that I noticed. No.
No.
Okay. So like if you watched the very first event in Vegas and you watched this event, you wouldn't be able to tell a difference.
No. No. I don't think so. Not that I know of. Not that I remember. But like what I'm thinking is
nothing's like jumping off the page.
Correct. What I'm thinking is Philo, Nate Sexton, even Nate Doss, that role is a very important disc golfer, knowledgeable person about the sport. The play-by-play person, it's more important that they know their role and know how to get stuff out of the color commentator than it is they know disc golf. Because the issue that we're running into a lot of times is when that person knows disc golf, they want to blur the lines between the two. And like sometimes it just gets really confusing as to who's supposed to talk when, who's not supposed to talk, what we're supposed to talk about and stuff like that. Whereas if you have someone that knows, stay in my lane, I am basically like the radio announcer where I'm talking about what the disc is doing, where the disc is landing, what putt they have, stuff like that. And then when I see something unique happening, an obstructed putt or something like that, or we're coming down the stretch, you can go to the person who has experience to walk you through what they're thinking of, the risk reward part of the sport, all of that, of like shot selection. That's what that's for. And I think this person, the play-by-play person, this, you're exactly right. That's something that people go to school for and all of that. That takes a lot of skill. There needs to be a good voice for it. The voice of disc golf, that person, that's the person that I think we look outside the sport and we find someone who is studying it or is good at play-by-play, and we just teach them the terms and basics of disc golf. I think that's a much easier way than getting someone who knows a lot about disc golf and trying to teach them the basics and everything of play-by-play commentary, and then we just figure out who they have the best chemistry with on the color side that can add that years of experience, knowledge, analytics too. Because at the end of the day, commentary is not easy. Like, I don't think I've seen several times when we've talked about commentary and stuff that like they're doing better than you could do, and I'm like, yeah, probably. I don't think I would ever be a good commentator, but at the same time, that's not what I ever went to school for or anything.
Yeah, that's the same thing of when you make an opinion about one of the disc golfers. Like, you're not saying you're better than a disc golfer.
Yeah,
you're
like, of course they could beat me.
But yeah, I mean, I think it shows how hard commentary is, because there are only probably a handful of commentators in all of sport that you would find a majority of people saying, yeah, I like them as a commentator.
Yeah.
So there's a lot, you know, even someone that you think maybe is a great commentator, there's still going to be tons and tons of people that can't stand them. So it is a very tough position. But I definitely think, obviously, where we're at right now, there's definitely a lot of room to improve.
Yeah, it's something that we've seen over years. The Pro Tour continue to be willing to make changes and adjustments on and be willing to keep trying new things. So I'm not super stressed about it because it's something where we've seen so many changes that it's obvious they are aware of problems as they happen. But they're also, the Pro Tour is a very methodical, think it through, slowly make changes versus just like snap and it happens change type company. So I think it's something that, you know, give a year and a half from now, we're not even going to really be, we'll be talking about like your typical commentary issues and not so much of like basic fundamental, like this is just getting ridiculous issues.
Yeah. I think commentary is kind of like sprinkles, right? Where it's like, I want ice cream and I'm going to enjoy ice cream by itself. But if I get sprinkles on it, it's going to enhance my ice cream.
Yeah.
But I still want ice cream, so I'm going to still eat it even if I get there and there's no sprinkles. So I think for the most part, no one's really going to be tuning. Like, no one's going to tune in to watch disc golf and then the commentary be bad and be like, oh, I can't stand this. Now, they might say, I can't stand this, I'm just going to watch post-produced. Yeah, that definitely is a possibility for sure. And obviously, that's probably something that the Disc Golf Pro Tour doesn't want to have happen. But I think people that are, you know, tuning into disc golf and seeking it out, I don't think commentary is going to be the make it or break it for people.
All right.
Couple more, Saz.
Okay. This wasn't one of the questions, but I was talking to a friend about this and I want you guys' input.
Let's hear it.
What do you guys think about, you know how Jomez shows the names of the discs?
As a graphic?
Yes. And also, commentators will throw out names of the disc, like, oh, this is Calvin's Draco he's throwing, or oh, this is Brody's Clear Zone. What do you guys think about that? Is that free advertising for the manufacturer?
I mean, surely you know where we think about this, Silas.
We've talked about this so many times.
I just talked about it for 30 minutes on Grip Lock 2 days ago.
Silas, we've brought this issue up many times.
I don't think Silas listens to our show.
I don't think he does either.
I think he just produces and reads comments.
I don't think he listens to anything we say.
No, I was talking to a friend about this, and they...
Who's the friend? Name the source.
Name the source?
Yeah, just keep
just up. First name. Just first name.
Was it Trevor?
No, it wasn't Trevor.
Thank goodness.
Was it Connor?
No, it wasn't.
It was Brad.
No, it wasn't Brad. all business Brad, man. He doesn't mess around.
No, so I don't like it, Silas. We'll just
you
put
don't
it
like
that
it.
Way.
Okay.
I don't mind the graphics.
Okay.
When they're correct. Jomez does a good job being correct.
Yeah, post-produced, like with what Jomez is doing, sure. That's fine.
But
hey, heck, maybe even they're getting a little cut from some of the manufacturers to do it.
Here's
your problem with not having not saying the right disc?
Yes, lots of times. Here's even a great yeah, this is one of the all-time ones.
Major issue.
Chris Dickerson threw a buzz and instead of just saying a buzz, they decided to say that was his buzz. You know, that's his Tour Series mold for this year through Discraft. I mean, if I'm dynamic disc, I'm like, what the heck? Ricky threw his Tour Series felon on hole one. You didn't call that out. Like, I mean, that's where the issues start coming in. It's like, that's a whole new step. That's beyond just mold. Now we're talking about a specific run of a disc of like, that's actually, you know, he has a Tour Series one this year through Discraft. And also it could
How
be picky and choosy of like, they apparently didn't really know much about Gavin's bag. So Prodigy gets on there. Where's their benefit? They didn't say much about that's his X4. That's his M4. That's his whatever he's throwing. I don't know because they didn't know. So like now it's being picky and choosy.
So it's just on whether the commentator knows discs of the manufacturer.
I think it's just a bad idea. Or if they like the person too. How much do we have to pay to get like a little, oh, that was a blah, blah, blah destroyer. You can pick that up on foundationdisc.com.
We sponsor the graphic. We solve it all.
Like how much?
We solve the problem. We pay for the advertising. This is genius.
There you go.
That we intellectual property. No one takes that.
Like, No, I'm saying how much do we have to slide under the table to just have every single time they say
we're just paying Ian, like, directly.
Yeah.
We're just paying Ian much. like $20 and like every single time he says a disc, he can say, you know, you can pick that up at foundationdisc.com.
Or we just give him
a little, like every time, you know, every time we get someone coming over, we here you go. Little percentage.
But that's the problem, Size.
You're going to have issues come up all sorts of place when you're doing basically free advertising. And
it's wrong a lot of the times, too.
Yes.
They called Ricky's Sake Bomb Slammer his Harp, his Justice, and his Slammer when they was all the same disc. Yeah. And it just got called. It gets to the point where it's distracting from the coverage more than it's adding to the coverage. And that's what the commentary team's there to do.
Thus, do you have any comments of people wanting us to talk about flight numbers?
No, everyone's just flaming me in the comments.
Yay!
But there's
let me tell you from experience, you get used to it.
Yeah, hey, that's all right. I don't see any topics in there.
All
still.
Right, no more topics. I will say, I noticed on MVP's website, I thought this was fascinating. Their discs, like on their website, where you can learn more about their discs, are grouped by speed. But instead of just being speed, it's grouped by rim width to show like all of our 9 speeds are whatever millimeter rim width. See, like now I can understand the numbers behind that. So instead of it just being 9 speeds, it's like, this isn't going to be accurate, but 10 millimeter rim width. If we're talking flight numbers, there's something for you.
Dude, I went deep in a 2-hour debate about I don't believe in glide at Longhorn Steakhouse.
Who is debating you?
Oh, I got some people on my side.
Oh gosh.
at the end of it, Aaron Gossage was like, yeah, I think you're right. I was like, oh, no. I know. This is what I've been saying the whole time. Also, I told him too about your putter situation of where you're like, no, this putter has zero glide. And then we tested it and you're like,
it's out of my bag. Yeah. Man. I don't want to.
You're like, yeah, they actually all fly exactly the same.
It's very similar. Yeah. It's out of my bag. It hurts to say. The banger's back though. The banger GT's back in the bag.
Dude, so. Banger's fire.
Yeah.
With the groove track. Heck yeah.
That's back in the bag. And I've been loving it. It's what I was missing. We have another one, Silas. Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Somewhat?
So.
Kind of a topic? I don't like that reaction. That makes me uneasy. This will be it. This is the last one, Silas.
Oh, last one? Gotta get a good one then.
No, it can be any of them.
Oh, Hunter's got somewhere to go, man.
It's called bed. It's almost 10 o'clock. We did it later than normal.
It's almost 10 o'clock.
He's not a businessman. He's a business. Man,
we did it later than normal. If I have any hope of being at the gym in the morning, I need to get home.
Oh, yeah. Do you know how long my practice round was today? I was out there for like 5 hours, it felt like.
I got deep in the woods of Mayflower Hills and Beale's Treasure today, and I was out there for a lot longer than 5 hours. It was something. I almost applied for a job at Wendy's in between. It got bad.
Whoa.
Not really.
I saw one Wendy's was like offering like $15-16 an hour. Is that like the going rate for like just like a low end job?
A lot of them. Starbucks is over at 18, and you get like healthcare and college benefits at Starbucks.
I was getting paid $7.50 an hour to be a camp counselor, and it was me and another person that didn't do anything. And we were watching over 500 kids, and I had to come up with skits to make 500 kids laugh and be happy. $7.50 an hour. That wasn't that long ago. I'm not that old. What is going on?
I mean, yeah, that's fair. No topics. Are we calling it done?
We got.
You don't have any topics in the chat. I refuse to believe that. I'm going to the chat myself.
No, here we go. Ask Brody if he prefers polo or t-shirts.
So I was just waiting for a good one. Oh, what'd you? Oh. You like, might get into this.
Polos might get versus into this t-shirts. Debate.
Yeah, okay, here we go. Polos versus t-shirts.
We might get into this debate because I have now flipped. script. Oh. Initially, I was heavily in. We need to dress like golf. We need to like have everyone needs to be wearing polos. Everyone needs to be doing this. Like I was tucked in shirts. I was on that when I first came in. I think I have completely 180'd. I'm on the other side of the fence. Two reasons. And I'll hear your guys' take because I actually don't know where you guys stand on this.
I don't know where I stand. Two reasons. Yet. Convince me.
First one. If you saw someone walking through the woods on a trail and they were wearing some khakis, a polo tucked in and a belt, would you be like, that person looks, what? Why are they hiking in that? Another question. If I said, hey, you guys want to go on a hike, are you ever putting on polos to go on a hike?
No.
Okay. Third thing, how many people have you ever seen in a outside of a tournament, outside of tournaments, how many times have you ever seen someone show up to play disc golf in a polo or tucked in shirt?
Very rarely.
No. Don't talk about professionals. I'm talking about
basically never.
No one.
Very rarely. I won't say when no. You go one, to fall, I've definitely seen.
You go to, when you yeah when you go to Falling Creek, the majority of people, are they wearing polos or are they wearing just whatever they want?
They're wearing whatever they want to wear.
Whatever.
Okay. Why? Why aren't they wearing polos?
More comfortable.
Comfort.
Okay.
You got more also, reachability, flexibility.
Why aren't you wearing polos when you go hiking?
Comfort. I mean, I don't wear a polo unless I'm made to. Yeah. So my answer is always going to be comfort. I don't even wear a polo on the golf courses around here. So I'm the wrong person for this answer.
Yeah. So this is where I think I've flipped because I don't think we need to be like golf in this scenario, right? No. Where I know everyone's like, what the heck, Brody? You want disc golf to turn into golf? Nope. Not in this scenario. I don't think it makes sense for disc golfers to wear polos. Like when I was all over the foliage and the ground at W.R. Jackson. Okay. I probably still have some leaves and some mud from W.R. Jackson because I was all over it and all in it all week. It's just weird seeing someone like stretch out in an awkward position in a polo and in khaki pants and get like mud all on them and all. I just think it's a different. I think it's a different sport. I think it requires a different athletic attire.
So how do you get a sense of professionalism look wise when that you go without a collar?
That is the trick. Because if you look at the NBA, look at soccer, look at
it's all
whatever
regulated.
Other sports.
I guess we could look at tennis. What's tennis's rules and regulations?
Tennis, that's a good one. Tennis is a good one.
Have to wear polos, right?
No, exactly. But they look professional. Why? Yeah. What's their regulations that prevent someone from showing up in a? And I don't know. I don't even know what an awful tennis outfit would be. But like, how do they all look put together in professionalism?
They just match.
Yeah, but like, how do they make everyone in tennis match? I guess is my question.
I don't think there is a matching thing though, Silas. I think he's saying like no one's showing up in like Jordan.
Standard. I think the sport's like been around for so long. It's just what you're expected to wear.
So if I wanted to play a tennis match in orange camo shorts, normal camo t-shirt, and a backwards trucker hat, yeah. I'm getting out there?
No, you're not stepping foot on my tennis court.
I mean, I think Nadal has worn some outrageous tennis outfits.
But he's still like Nico is a great example of someone who wears like outrageous stuff, but it all works. Like Nico still looks put together a lot of the time. Like he'll wear like a loud cheetah print shirt and joggers, but you're like, dang, Nico looks fire today. Like there's just something like, I don't know how to word it, but like people can just look put together even when they're wearing wild stuff. Like how do you get, because that's what the professionalism side is. Is it just like people dressing these people?
I don't know. I'm looking at some of these female tennis outfits. They're all female. Do I need to put male outrageous tennis outfits?
I'm gonna Google wild tennis outfits.
I feel like it's just a standard thing. Like, you go to tennis, you go to a country club.
Actually,
and you're
Andre Agassi
played in denim. I mean, that's ridiculous. He played in denim shorts. I mean, this looks like a UPS driver.
I mean, how long ago was that, though?
Roger Federer looks like a UPS driver in this thing.
What was it, like a pro event?
When was it?
I need a year.
He's not. Can I send you this thing to see this?
Okay, so the principal rule is that players are expected to present themselves in a professional manner and wear recognized tennis attire. Gym shorts and t-shirts are ruled out.
All right, there you go.
At Wimbledon, clothing is required to be predominantly white.
All white.
What?
Yeah, you didn't know that? You didn't know that? Are you kidding me?
It's more like golf.
I'm glad this is not a podcast.
What?
This was a sports podcast, you would be getting roasted right now.
I've never really watched much tennis.
I know, but everyone knows Wimbledon is white.
I mean, not wearing white. Come on, man.
Do you know you're not supposed to wear white to a wedding?
Yes.
Okay. It's basically the same thing.
Well, not really by any means.
Very similar.
They all have their own dress code.
Yeah.
Grand slams, every player shall dress and present themselves and play in a professional manner. But like that's ambiguous. Just, what's a professional manner?
Oh, that's just the nature of the sport. You're expected to
What?
You're expected
How do you define the word professional?
You're expected to look put together.
Define put together.
How long has the sport been around? For a long time.
But like that doesn't answer the question. Like, you can't define put together. You see what I'm saying? Like, there's nothing that, like, is preventing someone.
Yeah, put together is what... I don't know.
Look at me, though, right now. I need a haircut and a shave real bad. So, I think, like, that's also something that probably you can do. Like, that's something that at a job, right? When you have a job, they'll tell you, like, you need to make sure that you maintain your hair. Right? Like, you can't just, like, certain jobs will allow you just to come in and be willy-nilly with what you're looking like on your face. So
a lot of times, like, they just outlaw certain things, like sweatshirts, sweatpants, t-shirts, jeans, or cutoffs.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Sweatshirts, gym shorts, dress shirts, t-shirts.
But then again, in tennis, you're not getting dirty, like Birdie was saying. You know?
No, but, like, tennis attire is very similar to disc golf attire, like wearing dry-fit shirts and shorts.
Yeah,
I think tennis attire matches what disc golf is doing way more than golf attire.
Yeah,
yeah, I would agree.
I still somewhat stand by my regulate
more
the pants.
Active. I mean, tennis is a more active sport.
This is where it's wild though, because I love it, because I feel like some of the people that don't like my takes because I'm trying to make disc golf too much like ball golf. What are they supposed to do now? Because I'm going the other way. I'm saying I'm all for the crazy jerseys and the athletic shorts and all this stuff. Like, I don't think we should.
I don't know if I'm all for the crazy jerseys. I think
maybe that's in like
that's
players' contracts.
There's some type of line.
Hey, maybe that's in players' contracts. You gotta look put together. Huh?
No, but it could be from the Pro Tour. Because then what if you get a player who's not under contract just pops off?
Yeah, good for him.
No,
it's all about your brand.
No, it's about the Pro Tour's brand.
Right.
That is
true. Also be
it's
about,
not about the other brands.
It could be about the manufacturer's brand.
Hold on. I did want to say, I don't think polos and like golf attire essentially should be outlawed.
No.
Like, if you want to wear that, that's fine. But I don't think... Someone that wants to wear a dry fit, nice, whatever with athletic shorts, like shouldn't be allowed to wear that. Because to me, that makes more sense to play in than golf attire. Like golf attire a lot of times is not super comfortable, but it's fine when you're golfing. Because a lot of times you're just driving around a cart, popping out for a couple, you know, walk a couple, swing a golf ball that is way less movement than it is throwing a frisbee. And then also golf attire, you're never like walking through thorns, you're never like getting on the ground, like there's a lot of things that
golf
you do
I play.
So here's what we should do. We should just copy and paste the rules of tennis. and their attire.
Yeah, I think we can start there.
I mean, is that acceptable, Brody?
I think the way tennis went was smart of just like outlawing certain items.
Like gym shorts, jeans.
You should not be on the podium. I don't think you can already, but I'm just saying like stuff like that. You can just pick and choose a few things, outlaw that, and then we already have athletic.
Like sleeveless, because the tennis allows sleeveless. What about sleeveless in disc golf? I think that's kind of, I don't know. I don't know if it works. I haven't seen it yet.
I don't know
if it works. It works in tennis really well because you just freaking see Nadal's python.
I was going to say, so it matters a lot about the muscles because like I don't ever wear tank tops because my arms are just all, there's no definition. So I look awful in them. But some people can pull them off because I got definition. Just ain't me.
That could be a backfire if the wrong people are wearing tank tops out there and it also depends on the tank top.
Like if someone shows up in these like bright neon Foundation Nation tank tops we put out, you're not looking professional in that. Yeah, that's not working.
Well, that's not active wear.
I'm wearing my puffin shirt.
That's not dry fit material, so yeah, you couldn't wear
that. That's true.
Boom.
Roasted. All right. We just solved it.
All right.
No, we didn't. No. But there you have it. All right, that'll wrap it up. We got Jonesboro coming up this weekend. We'll hear next week all about what went down there, how the tournament went for Brody and all of that. Be sure to tune in on, I believe, Thursday for the Grip Lock preview show of Jonesboro. And next week we might actually be in the same, we'll be in the same spot, Brody. Possibly. I'll be in Missouri on Tuesday.
Now, where are you doing in Missouri?
We have a bogey bro battle on Wednesday.
Wait, you guys in St. Louis?
Yeah.
Wait, what day are you going to be there?
Tuesday and Wednesday.
Dang, what are we going to do for the... Oh, gosh. Wait, we need to figure that out, actually.
Yeah,
Let's figure that out right now. What are we doing for debate night?
Yeah.
Because we can I have to dark horse as soon as the skins match is done. I got a dark horse to Emporia.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's a brand new course. Are we filming? Do we film? You get there Tuesday, not Monday?
We get late Monday night. We'll be there like 9 o'clock, but we're doing a tour of Gateway's factory Monday night.
Do we film the pod at Monday night?
We could. Trevor and Connor will be there. We can just have like a four-way debate night.
Maybe, and do a pre-recording for Tuesday. Because I literally, Tuesday... I'm waking up doing a skins match and then driving to Emporia and I'm on the courses until. Yeah.
So maybe we'll record it Monday night and then just post it on Tuesday.
Yeah, I think that's what we have to do.
We can premiere it on Tuesday, so then there's still a chat and stuff. Maybe we'll do something like that. A little hybrid experience for you all. Regardless. Next week we'll have some form of debate night go down. Should be a good time. We'll be in Missouri and get some more bogey row battles. And obviously Jonesboro Open goes down this week. Ledgestone drop happens on Friday. Lots of good swirly ESP coming in that, and also the new Ripped expansion packs that changes how you play Ripped forever. Super excited about that. That also happens on Friday, so be sure to tune in to foundationdiscs.com for all of that stuff. We'll also post it on all of our social medias if you're not following us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, all that good stuff.
Grand opening. Any more info we can give people?
May 7th. I'll give the date. We'll have the official grand opening post probably tomorrow with all the details of what's going down that week. There will be some dark horse items in more than one way at the grand opening. So super excited about that. If you're anywhere close to the area, we'd love to have you. Again, we'll have more posts about that coming out. I think tomorrow we'll announce everything. May 7th. The Saturday.
I might have to get real dark horse. I'm not going to lie about that. I got to talk to Kelsey about this situation.
May 7th.
I think I'm going to be flying in and then driving with her to Dallas.
Yeah.
Because we got to be out of the house. And then I think I'm going to be flying back.
Oh, you're in, out, in.
I think so. We sold our house. We have to move. We have to get out.
I thought you were there the whole weekend. We'll figure that out.
I got to talk healthy on this.
May 7th. That's all I know. That's all I'm good for. We'll talk to you all next week.
Oh, boy.
check the mic and make sure it sound right, boys.